2.
If I had known you were going to record me, I would have used my original voice.
Like this. Big bang.
Hubble. Well, yeah. Looks like we had a network outage here in the bunker. I mean, I thought I was far enough underground that the storm clouds high above the mountains of Appalachia would not affect what I am doing way down here, but boy, was I ever wrong. You know, Race, you know what I think it is?
2 minutes. What?
Without question, I believe it's the Illuminati.
Well, I know one thing for sure.
What's that?
When you open the show, you need to be careful, but start off with news from the front.
And it's just in with Mr. Race Hobbs bringing us news from the front.
Hobbs.
Hobbs. By God, there's five of them.
News from the front.
What's our time there, Hobbs?
1 minute.
Okay, I got you. Check 2, 3.
Okay.
Are you in the military or law enforcement,
no.
Security professional, or search and rescue? Or maybe you're just a serious outdoor enthusiast? If so, FNG and...
Race.
Yes.
What's our time again?
We've got 60 seconds.
60, okay. Because I need to talk to you real privately and real quick about something, okay?
Hurry up. Let me put something else in.
Yeah, do that.
Put Dolan in. Hello, Mr. Terry.
Okay. Here we go.
Hodgkins.
Yes, sir.
Activate the cone of silence.
The cone of silence?
Okay, so in case this call is being monitored, Race, what if the Illuminati really are watching what we're doing? Is it are or is?
I don't know. You're the damn rider.
I mean, good thing nobody can... How come I have echo on my voice and I can't hear any on yours? Are you or are you not in the cone of silence here, Race?
The cone.
Yeah, get your head in the cone, damn it.
I'm in the cone.
We're cone heads.
I have no perspective.
Cone heads. You see, it's a sagittal crest. Sasquatch is a cone head as well. Extra space on the cranium, which allows the muscles conducive to a large mammal and the powerful jaws needed for the consumption of raw vegetables like a Sasquatch presumably
vegetables.
Would eat. Vegetables. Yeah.
Cone of silence.
I think it's pretty brilliant. Okay, we can lift it now. Hang on. There we go. Okay, no more cone.
Clear. We're clear.
What's our time looking like?
16 seconds.
Thank you, Hobbo.
2.
Are you familiar with a strange species known as the Hobbo spider? Oh, wait. No, that's Hobbo spider. My bad. Standing
eight,
by.
8 seconds.
Paranormal powerhouse of live alternative talk radio.
Alley-oop.
KGRA, the planet.
You're live.
Politics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Adams.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Gremium Bunker, welcome one and all to your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual, where we explore science and mysteries of time and space. I'm Micah Hanks, your host. And you know then, here and now, if you are listening to this, that you are listening to the one and only Gremium Report. Glad, as always, to be here with you. Tonight, we're going to be taking a bit of an esoteric foray together into anomalous musicalia, as we look at a lot of different interesting instances, I should say, in the world of pop music, and how they relate not only to esoteric themes like spiritualism, but also Modern Conspiracy. And we're going to look at one of my all-time favorite stories, that of the late John Lennon and his UFO encounter in New York. I think that over the years it's been turned into not a ridicule piece so much as I think just one of those kind of, oh, well, you know, and John Lennon said he saw a UFO. Looking into this myself, I've found that it obviously had quite an impact on his life. And so together in hour two, we're going to look at that. We're also going to get a quick update from Scotty Roberts here during the first hour about yours and mine in terms of our mutual favorite events that we can all attend together each year. I happen to attend this event every year. Of course, being a co-founder of the original Paradigm Symposium, that's the one we're talking about. And we'll get Scotty to give us an update on what's going to be happening. I will be at this one this year. My friend Maria contacted me from Inner Traditions and said, hey, you still going to be in Minneapolis? I said, absolutely. And then a couple of weeks after that, I'll be headed over with our good friend, the D-Man, Richard Dolan, over to Leeds, England for the Exopolitical Summit. And as a matter of fact, it's not just Rich and I. It's also going to be Robbie Graham, a wonderful guy and a fellow who I've been in touch with for quite a while now. And, of course, my good buddy Mike Cleland, one of the only guests on this program to have ever been live in studio in the Graylian Bunker. Not that I'm against having people in studio. I just, you know, well, often, frankly, this environment can scare them. And if you don't follow me on Twitter, I'll give you an example of why. You follow me on Twitter and you go and you look at the photos that I've posted, and probably the most recent one is a very candid shot of me down here in the bunker. Hard at work one night, and it looks like a screenshot out of a sci-fi movie. That'll give you a good idea what is so terrifying for people, first-timers, when they come down here into the bunker. And no doubt that's also probably why it's so hard to find good help around here. I'm almost to the point where I just want to put a want ad out. Wanted companions, people who are excellent broadcasters with an esoteric mind and who aren't afraid of, closed spaces. Now, it's not a tiny enclosed space, so I'm not necessarily saying you'll get claustrophobic, but, you know, some people get weirded out when they go miles underground, and once they realize where they are, once the setting sets in, I guess it can be a little odd, indeed. So I hear tell that there's going to be something incredible happening tonight, something that I think a lot of us have been waiting for, and I guess it already happened once and now has happened again. I guess we'll see how long it lasts this time. You probably know what I'm alluding to, and that, of course, is the return of Art Bell. That's right. We'll see, indeed, how things go for the Bell Man. People have been emailing me all about it all day and wanting my opinion on things, and I have to just say, I mean, you know, gosh, I've hardly had time to think about it. I've been doing all this show prep for this program. So, and speaking of hardly having time to think about things, got in off the road the other day, and yet again, we have another one, this Chattanooga incident, which I didn't want to even talk about. I didn't have it in the lineup, but people right up until about half an hour before airtime tonight, people were emailing me and tweeting at me. Jacob, one of our listeners, had tweeted, and, it's understandable. A lot of people want to hear about this. And, here's what we know right now. The alleged shooter, which is apparently, you know, in modern news speak, what we have to say. But the 24-year-old man who is accused of killing five U.S. service members in Chattanooga allegedly suffered from depression and drug abuse. We do know that. He was medicated, like a lot of children. This was provided, by the way, this was a press statement by a family representative to the AP. Although this individual wished to remain anonymous, he reportedly abused sleeping pills. And the shooter, that is. He also took opioids, painkillers, marijuana, and alcohol. This is a trend I'm seeing, by the way, a lot these days. In a lot of these shooting incidents, whether or not it is a determinant factor, I'm finding that more and more marijuana is referenced in these cases. I mean, even with the two men, Matt and Sweat, that escaped from the prison in New York, It was said that Matt not only got blistered, he got hammered on some booze he found, but also he'd been smoking marijuana, and this is why Mr. Sweat decided to abandon him and make a run for the border. Now, Abdulaziz, the shooter, held both U.S. and Jordanian citizenship. He and his parents made a mutual agreement to send the 24-year-old back to Jordan, where it was hoped he would sober up a little while. There were apparently some friends who were encouraging his prolific use of drugs and alcohol here in the United States. He'd been treated at least as early as age 13 by a psychiatrist, as was reported in The Independent. And he also apparently lost his job at a nuclear power plant in Ohio after failing a drug test back in March. It's just another troubling incident. Now, I should also note, by the way, that with the name, of course,
that he has and his heritage, apparently Jordanian, there are people with the ties overseas asking, more specifically, the Department of Justice looking into this right now, looking into whether or not he may have had any ties to terrorist groups. But this is what apparently a friend of Abdulaziz had actually said, that he had spoken about ISIS and had said that he considered them to be a stupid group and quote-unquote one who was doing wrong. So some have still argued that general jihadist propaganda may have inspired the attacks, but if indeed Abdulaziz had gone on record, well, apparently he didn't. These are anecdotal reports from people who knew him, but nonetheless, if there is some record of him having said ISIS is a stupid group that was doing wrong, it's all the more tragic that he would carry out a horrific attack like this and put himself on par with them and the kinds of things that they're doing. So it's truly disturbing. What can you say? You can say what everybody says. Our hearts go out to people. But, you know, at some point, I think, and this is the cold, hard reality, we're going to have to try and find out what it is about culture in the United States that is so conducive to these killings. We can take down flags, and we can point to opioids and marijuana and things like this and general depression that young people face, but, you know, having these discussions may help, but I don't think that anything yet is proactively seeking to try and understand the social problem that is so obvious to us right now. So I won't go on about that, but I did, you know, out of respect to the families, out of respect to the listeners on this program who do like to hear and who like the opinions expressed on this program by yours truly, you know, I felt that it's important we touch on that. So we've touched on it. Moving along, did you catch that footage from the J-Ban Open? Okay, the World Surf League reported on this. This was incredible. We had a finalist out there, okay, Mick Fanning. He's an Australian. And he was out there paddling along. They had the cameras trained on him. And then something that we've talked about a good bit on this program already happened to him. And fortunately, it was a near miss as events unfolded live with cameras rolling.
Last season, as you look at Fanning on the rankings, oh, you can see a little splash.
Oh.
Folks, that was more than a little splash. It was a great white shark.
Looks like Fanning needing...
You're about to hear the sirens go off here.
Needing some assistance. He's swimming into the beach. As we sound the horn to stop the final. Fanning still swimming on his own right. To the assistance of the jet skis. He'll hop on the sled and reset. So climbing up with his own ability as he keeps his head down. Fanning with a thumbs up. He is okay. Rushing to the water safety. His leash chewed off as he shakes this one off.
Now, he was interviewed very shortly afterward. Obviously still shaken. And this is what you're about to hear, actually, with Mr. Manning in this statement that he gave, in which... He's still flustered. I mean, it's incredible. I'm thinking at least give the guy enough time to dry off and to allow the reality of what just happened to set in.
Like, just tripping, and then I saw Ace and Jared and Fletch, and that's when it all just kicked in. And then I saw the footage. I'm just tripping. But, yeah, I'm totally fine. I've got nothing wrong with me. There's like a small depression in my board, and just my leg rope got bitten, and I'm just like, just totally tripping out.
Now, this, of course, on the heels of all of these reports, and we've covered it a bit on this program, not because it's something unexplained or paranormal, but I'm interested in these reports that do seem to involve more and more shark attacks being reported this year. And again, I've seen a lot of commentators out there, as I've said before, trying to say, look, there's really nothing to this. Nothing to see here. Move along. It's incredible how skeptical of certain things people will tend to be, and it's almost as though certain individuals have this deep-set need to be the one who presents the counter-narrative. Well, it may appear like there are more shark attacks happening, but that's really probably not the case. Let's rein in on this. Or should I say reel in on this? Yeah, see what I did there? Where's my drum effect? But anyway, but there have been a lot of these reports, and I tell you what, North Carolina, my home state, has been no stranger to reports of this kind.
Shark surge, fear at the beach this weekend because of the jump in attacks over the past month. Some calling for the beaches in North Carolina to be shut down. ABC's Philip Mena is in the Outer Banks with more. Good morning, Philip.
Amy, good morning. Today is the start of the busiest weekend of the year here at the site of the latest shark attack. These attacks are happening off the Carolina coast at an alarming rate. But why here and why now?
This morning, high alert along the East Coast after 11 shark attacks off the shores of the Carolinas this year, most in just the last 3 weeks.
It's pretty scary.
Yeah, I wouldn't go out there. Not now.
Experts say the increase in attacks this year could be a combination of four factors. First, drought conditions, limiting fresh water along the coast. The ocean water is saltier, which sharks like. Throw in warmer water than usual, add a surge of fish for food, and factor in more people than usual at the beach. And it's a recipe for disaster.
So experts are actually saying that there really may be more to this, in other words. And yet again, if you don't believe what you just heard, I mean, just watch that footage of Mr. Manning almost being eaten. Now, granted, it wasn't Jaws, but it was a good-sized shark, and had it not bitten his board before it got to him, well, you know, he may have lost a limb, and we're very, very, very glad that he wasn't the latest casualty in these shark attacks. In fact, actually, the World Surf League issued a statement: "We are incredibly grateful that no one was seriously injured today. Mixed composure and quick acting in the face of a terrifying situation was nothing short of heroic, and the rapid response of our water safety personnel was commendable. They are truly world-class in what they do." So anyway, it's just incredible right now. Makes you never want to step foot in the ocean again. And my friend Susan Davidson was headed down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina with her family on vacation this week. And I told her, I said, "Susan, just do me one favor. Come back with all four limbs, please." And she said, "Don't worry. At the resort we're going to be staying at, there is a pool. I will be visiting the pool rather than the ocean water." Kind of sad. We all like swimming in the ocean, but I mean, there are obviously changes occurring right now. So, speaking of things that are happening in the world, moving away from the shoreline, let's head a little south to Texas, where purportedly right now, this is how things are sounding down there. Now, of course, this is purported audio. If I can get these guys to tone down the gunfire just a little bit, please. Really, nobody wants to hear that. This is, of course, in relation to all of the hubbub surrounding the Jade Helm thing. We talked about it a bit on the Graylian Report, especially in relation to the mysterious closings of Walmarts. And, you know, I always tell you this. We will report on something. I don't necessarily endorse the idea. And at the end of the program, we said it's highly unlikely that this is actually preparation for a secret military takeover in the Lone Star State. Of course, if anything happens, Cam and Kyle down there at Expanded Perspectives will be sure and let me know first and foremost. But there was a op-ed that appeared in the Dallas News this morning that Mimi Schwartz wrote. And she brought some very interesting commentary as well as some historical precedent, although she framed this very carefully when she wrote it. And I wanted to share a little of this op-ed here in relation to Texans who were worrying about what some perceive as an imminent invasion. Okay, with this Jade Helm 15 thing. Now, she writes, "A few months ago, the federal government announced it would be holding military training exercises in 7 states in the Southwest, including Texas. And the troops would literally bring in heavy artillery. Now, maybe the military should have been a little more careful with the rollout of the exercise, which began last week. The plan was to divide the designated lands into primarily permissive and hostile territories, with Texas falling into the latter category. But to some people, the government's plan to train service members to work in complex environments looked like something else, a plot to take over the state. This is in preparation for the financial collapse and maybe even Obama not leaving out of office." This according to a Texas-based conspiracy theorist and talk radio show host that we all know very well, Mr. Alex Jones. Now, that, of course, was followed by about 1 zillion internet cranks, Mimi writes, predicting the declaration of martial law. And then Governor Greg Abbott attempted to calm the populace by ordering the state guard to keep an eye out on the feds, of course. Well, or rather, the feds came next, though, with an action that did nothing, they said, to confirm the pre-election rumor that he was much smarter than his predecessor, Rick Perry. Remember, folks, this is an op-ed. She says, "I don't disagree with the observers who say that anti-Obama sentiment provided much of the fuel for this fire, but the local overreaction has its roots in Texas's DNA. Put another way, it wasn't so nutty to get bent out of shape about a hostile invasion by a supposed tyrannical government, at least if we look back 185 years ago. Now, consider that much of Texas, then part of Mexico, was settled by prickly Scott Irish types who had their own issues back home. Some of these folks were big movers in the events leading up to the Texas Revolution. In 1830, the Mexican government was getting very worried about the creeping Americanization of its Texas lands and the growing number of Anglo-Americans, a.k.a. Texians, who were living there. It began restricting immigration and raising taxes, setting up a customs house on a busy spot on the Trinity River in the soon-to-be town of Anahuac. Now, the man in charge of the Kentuckian, named Juan Davis Bradburn, who, for reasons true and imagined, became increasingly paranoid that Anglo settlers were going to declare their independence from Mexico, a series of assaults, arguments over slavery, and all sorts of other things soon followed. At one point, William Barrett was tied up and threatened with execution if the rebellious Texians didn't back off. Eventually, Bradburn was relieved of his command and hid out in corn cribs and creeks, eventually making his way to New Orleans. But Mexico also sent more troops to Texas. Now, in 1835, complaints about unfair taxation had resumed, and Travis returned with a 25-man militia and a cannon. He rebuffed some 40 Mexican troops, but the Mexican government issued an order for his arrest. Not surprisingly, this move outraged the Texians, and again, she spells that note, of course, in the historical context, T-E-X-I-A-N-S, even more. Meanwhile, sensing trouble in other quarters, the Mexican government demanded the return of a cannon it had previously given to the settlers of Gonzales, Texas, for protection from the Comanches. The locals there, already plenty mad about the bludgeoning of a resident by a Mexican soldier, declined to comply. The Mexicans then sent around 100 soldiers to take back the cannon, and before they retreated, the two sides exchanged fire. At some point, the Texians raised a homemade flag illustrated with the cannon and the phrase, "Come and take it," a sentiment later used by Texas lovers of recalled Blue Bell ice cream. If you ever had it, it was quite good, but, you know, sadly, of course, they had a little problem with contamination earlier this year. She goes on to say, every school child in Texas learned what followed: the defeat of the Alamo, the victory at San Jacinto, and the establishment of the Republic of Texas until 1845, when we joined the Union and subsequently seceded with the rest of the South. Those in the mental health professions might suggest a pattern. It would also suggest that over time patterns can be broken so that they don't lead to destructive events, but the deadly 1993 siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco were just plain silly ones, like believing a military exercise is a cover for an invasion. Many Texans have taken that advice. We're moving slowly into maturity, Mimi writes, but you know, there are always a few who take longer to get there. You know, again, I can't help but detect a little condescension there in her delivery, but I digress. Nonetheless, people are concerned about what's going on down there, and one of the big issues about conducting military operations, even though announced and even though coordinated with the state, in areas that are at least close to those being populated, the concern is, of course, that this could lead to, confusion among the populace and all manner of other kinds of things. We really are a society that is tied very closely to conspiracy. Just to give you another example really quickly, have you seen this one that's been going on, okay, about the Nintendo president? You know, we lost him the other day. The gentleman, sadly, had been diagnosed with, I believe, what was called cholangiocarcinoma. It's a relatively rare form of cancer, but it affects, areas of your body around the liver. It can require multiple operations or even a full liver transplant, and that's if you're fairly lucky. And it's extremely aggressive. Without successful surgeries, the patient's remaining time is much shorter, and like all cancers, it's sudden and often indiscriminate. And so, this is the stated cause of death, of course, but this hasn't stopped people from saying, you know, there's a broader conspiracy here. And you won't believe what that conspiracy actually involves. There are people right now, and this was reported by Rocket News, that are actually alleging that there is a Freemason conspiracy, and that they had this guy in their sights, and they took down the Nintendo president, Satoru Iwata. And this is what they're saying. This is actually something that was posted online in a document that was claiming that the Freemasons were secretly controlling, among other things, including the music industry, the video game industry. And portions of the document read as follows. Nintendo was selling playing cards when they got the idea to make game machines by the Japanese version of the Magnavox Odyssey 2 game console developed by a Jewish big-time technician. Now, they note that this document explains, of course, with complete anti-Semitic non-sequiturs, but here it goes on to say, this was all facilitated by the founder of Atari, Nolan Bushnell. The name Atari, you see, is derived from the Japanese word meaning to hit a target. It's actually a faction organized by the secret society of the Freemasons with the target of controlling the Japanese people. Oh, man. The way to do this was to rekindle the Space Invaders boom that was started earlier by guess who? Of course, the Jewish. And since that time, dignitaries of the Masonic Order have been behind the Japanese gaming industry and Nintendo, continuing to keep the people of Japan lazy and stupid. Oh, yeah, of course, one of the brightest technological, God almighty. Japan is arguably one of the, if not the brightest country in terms of technological innovation occurring. Lazy and stupid? What? This is ridiculous. So anyway, Rocket News reported it paints quite a bleak picture of a video game industry puppeteered by mysterious powers who not only make us fall in love with cuddly Pokemon and plumbers, but kill off even the most powerful of us if we get in their way. You know, it's to a point I really think, and yes, we have said many times on this program that, yeah, real conspiracies exist. Real conspiracies and cover-ups do occur, but we are in a point, I guess, in the progression of civilization, the dissemination of media, and the exchange of information and ideas through things like social media, that now conspiracy theories with little or no facts at all to support them run rampant. It's just the strangest thing in the world. And I, from time to time, am called a conformist just for trying to preach about this and say, folks, God almighty, don't believe everything that you hear. You know, just because somebody dies a horrible death as a result of a tragic illness, that doesn't mean that the Freemasons had it out for them. We'll come back with Scotty Robertson, a Paradigm Symposium 2015 update when we come back here on the Graylian Report. And welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. We have a special order of operations when it comes to the way that we do things around here. And for this gentleman who's joining me now, we have to have a very special way to introduce him. And that involves getting medieval. I believe we now have with us here, live on the program, Mr. Scotty Roberts. Sir, how are you?
Greetings and felicitations.
Well, that sounds good. Oh, man. Good to have you on, brother. I haven't been able to catch up with you a whole lot in the last few days myself with all that's been going on. So for all of you out there who have been emailing me and getting no response, that's why. I can't even call my buddy Scotty. I have to do it on my show. And we did this just for one reason, Scotty, just to get you on so we could just shoot the bull for a minute. No, I'm kidding, actually.
Fantastic. And I was just complaining yesterday that you and I hadn't talked in a couple of weeks almost.
Yeah.
We tried little messages back and forth, but the talking hasn't happened.
Yeah, well,
now I know why.
Everybody is so busy these days, you know, and of course in the summer months that just tends to happen. But with everything as busy as it is, that's why I wanted to get you on and talk about this wonderful event that you and I both happen to be a part of that occurs every October in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It is the Paradigm Symposium, and you know, this, of course, every year immediately after the event is fresh on everyone's mind. And in the summertime, it's either one of two things. It's something that is new to the ears of people or something that they are already thinking about. And I keep hearing from people, even in the far south, down there where it's Jade Helm territory, I've got people telling me, yeah, we're going to make the sojourn all the way up. We're going to be there this year. But for people who may not know what Paradigm Symposium is, I thought, let's get him on. Let's talk a little bit about it and what we have to look forward to for this year. So I give you the floor for the next few minutes, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, well, fantastic. I have the floor on the Graylian Report.
Yeah.
And that is, that's a feather in my cap, I think. And, you know, this is an event that really you conceived. And you and I together then built it into the Paradigm Symposium 2012, which was our first year. And it has grown, of course, since then. And this year, we are anticipating having a better show than ever.
Oh, good.
And each year, it seems to get better and better and better. And I've always said, I'm only going to do this as long as it's fun. And so far, it has not lost its fun quality. So we're okay. And for those of you who don't know what the Paradigm Symposium is all about, it really started as an effort through Intrepid Magazine, which I publish and Micah was writing for and working on with me. And he brought up the idea of trying to do an event of some kind. It developed into the Paradigm Symposium. It's really a place, I think the first year we said it has an eclectic cadre of some of the world's most esoteric thinkers.
It really does. It still does. Let me just also interject. You know, when I had any idea about doing... full disclosure here. We were joking around. I'd said...
Yeah, we were.
I'd said to you and I'd said to a few others, I'd said... An end-of-the-world party would be great, because we know that the world's really going to end on, you know, December 21st, 2012, or whatever it was. I said, let's just, if we're going to go out, let's go out happy, you know, in this.
I think you actually named it the Intrepid Magazine Graylian Report End-of-the-World Bash 2012.
Yeah, and you had a better idea, I think.
I just said that was a little wordy.
Yeah, well, I tend to be that way.
So, well, that's okay. You're the mouth of the South. You should be wordy.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'll never escape it. But anyway, go ahead.
So this year is going to be better than ever, I think. That's my opinion, because I'm part of it. I'm intricate. I live it every day. Now, I will say, for those of the people who know out there, these kinds of things don't get put together without strife and turmoil and ups and downs and things like that. We've had our share of that. And I always like to tell people, too, an event like this, for good or ill, to mention this, it costs extreme amounts of money. And so we're always working on the big fly in the ointment is, I wish I could do this for free. And so you're always out, you're looking for the funding and you're looking for things, advertising, to put it together and make it something that's profitable so you can do it again next year. It's like writing a book. You know, if you go to a publisher and you write a book for a publisher and a publisher says, hey, that was a wonderful, amazing book, but we only sold 12 copies, they're not going to publish your next book, usually. And yeah. So there is a business element to it that makes it, that's, I'd say, the most unfun part about the Paradigm Symposium is sitting at my desk conducting business when I'd rather be out doing stuff and doing the work and researching and so on. So I always like to put that little message in there about what we do, because it's not just by the seat of our pants. It's not just thrown together. These are things that we have to put a concerted amount of effort into to create something that works. And sometimes you hit hiccups in the road, you got to move beyond them. And you got to find ways. It's like you have to say, damn the torpedoes and full speed ahead. And that's what we have to do. And every year we seem to be at that point where there's something that wants to throw a wrench in the gears, and then you come around it. And you say, it's worth doing, because what we're presenting, I believe, is worthwhile information. This is something that is not just, hey, let's put on an event. You know, like, remember the Little Rascals or Our Gang? Hey, let's do a show. And they go to the clubhouse and do it. You know, it's an effort to put this together to do something that is worth disseminating information to the public.
Yeah.
And to people who want to join us. And I have likened this, especially it hit me last year. I had a lot of requests from people that said, are you going to do this as an online event? Can we watch it online? And I thought for a second, I said, absolutely not. You can't watch it online. I said, that would be like, maybe if Socrates had the technology, he would have done online seminars. We don't know. But I rather liken the Paradigm Symposium to sitting at the feet of the great thinkers. You can watch something online for 45 minutes to an hour and a half, and you can glean some information. But, Mike, as you know so well, there is nothing better than sitting through a lecture or a presentation or a series of them than being able to rub shoulders with those people in other places of the event, in the lobby, at dinner, in the vendor room. In the what we have dubbed now the after effects, where we you and others have brought their musical instruments, and there's a lot of singing, and there's playing of music, and people mingle. And something I've asked all our speakers to do is, don't just give your presentation on the stage. We want you mingling for all 4 days of the event, so people get to know who you are and get to ask you questions up close and personal. So I tell all of our speakers, be ready for that.
Which is funny, by the way, you know, because a lot of people, we've had people in the past who have had it in their contract. We have no obligation to mingle with anybody. We have no obligations to hang out with the organizers. And inevitably what always happens is, graciously, the people who are speakers at the Paradigm Symposiums, they're always there interacting with the...
Yes.
I mean, it's... And I think that it's interesting because I maintain, with all the different events that I've been to and that you've gone to and some that you and I've been at together, you very seldom, if ever, see the kind of social environment that Paradigm Symposium has that incorporates, you know, arts and culture and music and camaraderie, you know, all those things in with the more serious side of things during the daytime, which is the, you know, back-to-back lectures and presentations, panel discussions. And the lectures, you know, while I think that's really at the heart of what Paradigm Symposium is, it's really cool that there are these additional elements. I mean, it's in a comfortable environment. I've had people say, I don't know if I'd want to be in Minneapolis in October. I don't remember one time when it was unbearable, though. I mean, it's always really nice weather.
You know, it's funny. When we were planning this the first year in 2012, I said last year, October of 2011, it was sunny and in the 80s that weekend.
Yeah.
But now, every weekend since, it's been, you know, a little rainy. It's been nice and blustery on some days. You know, the weather goes in cycles. Minnesota, the misnomer about Minnesota is that it is a frozen tundra wasteland year-round. Right now, not so bad today, but we're in the upper 80s with really high humidity, and so you want to stay inside in the air conditioning. And October is one of those beautiful transitional months between the summer and the winter. And it's where the fall colors are all here, and so it's generally very nice.
Yeah.
We've had a couple of years in a row where we've had a little sprinkle and rain and stuff like that at the Paradigm, but it's generally a very nice time of year to have an event. And something else that I wanted to say about this mingling after hours and this talking with the speakers is that how many times have you heard somebody like Graham Hancock or somebody like let's go to our list from this year, like Barry Fitzgerald from Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks, you know, Peter Robbins, Nick Redfern, all of these names that come up in these fields, how often do you get the opportunity to sit and have a drink with them in a lobby and probe their minds on questions that you have about things they've either written or things that you have experienced or things that you have questions on? That is what is the beautiful thing. We call it a family atmosphere at the Paradigm Symposium. We don't mean, hey, bring the kids along and let's go on rides. It's not that kind of family atmosphere. The family atmosphere is that we have built a family of people that love this event, that support this event, and it grows bit by bit every year because they want to bring their friends to come into this family that's been created by those people who are here.
By the way, about the bringing people to the event thing, what's also interesting is, Scotty, I've been seeing a bit more every year that there are people who are not necessarily speakers at the event, but names unto themselves, who will show up at the event. You know, I think we had the actor Justin Long showed up a couple of years ago. Randall Carlson showed up last year. I mean, again, he wasn't actually on the roster, and he showed up with Graham Hancock. This year, he's one of the preeminent speakers and really somebody who's been attracting an awful lot of attention with his ideas and, of course, having garnered the attention of Graham Hancock. So, you know, Randall's going to be there this year. Another first-timer, of course, is Travis Walton, but best known in UFO circles, but a guy who gives a very interesting presentation about how what happened to him is nothing like what that movie, Fire in the Sky, displayed.
He said, I asked him that question on air once. I said, now, what about the scene where, you know, you were delivered back from your abduction and you're naked outside the phone booth? He goes, I was not naked.
None of that happened. Yeah.
So that didn't happen. And by the way, we are screening the new documentary, Travis, that one of our other speakers, Peter Robbins, was one of the producers on, and he's bringing the producer of the movie along with him. And I can't think of her name off the top of my head, but she will be there as well during that screening. And, you know, we have a cast of speakers this year. Some people you may not have heard much about because of the circles they're in. But something we have always striven to do at the Paradigm Symposium, Mikey, you know this very well, is that we didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves in one category. We are all about UFOs, or we are all about ancient aliens, despite the first year having the cast of Ancient Aliens there and Prometheus filming them. They actually filmed, folks, if you watch a show, the show Ancient Aliens on H2, you may have seen the Von Daniken legacy that they did for Eric Von Daniken. Well, that was filmed all at the Paradigm Symposium 2012. And so while we have thematic things going on at the event, this year we cover everything from Earth geometry, cosmology, ufology, history, research into kind of the mysterious things of the Earth that Barry Fitzgerald is so very good at doing. I was going to say psychogeometry. That's not what it's called. Geometric theory with Thomas Fusco. We've got Lon Milo Duquette, who is, if you have never heard of Lon Milo Duquette, he's our keynote speaker. He is very big in the occultist movement. Now, people confuse sometimes a cult with Satan, and that's not what it's about. It's ancient mysteries, ancient knowledge. And he's part of this Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica, I think it's called Catholica, if I remember how that's pronounced. He's written several books on Western mystical traditions, Freemasonry, Tarot, Kabbalah, ceremonial magic, Enochian magic. And he is quite the speaker in that circle. And so for Lon Milo Duquette to be here is an amazing coup for us. And on top of that, he's a musician.
Oh, well, you know, we have a lot of those that come out and attend. You know, Scotty, by the way, we're almost out of time here, but I also did want to mention, you know, in fairness, there have been people who, you know, will say from time to time, you know, Mike, I know from listening to your show that you gravitate much more toward skepticism. You know, when you give lectures, you often are the guy who is billed as the skeptic. You know, not everything at Paradigm Symposium necessarily seems to cater to that sort of a thing. So why do you go to an event like this? And I'm going to tell you, as interesting as I find UFOs, hermeticism, you know, any number of these subjects, I do not have a problem personally with discussing these kinds of things, because to me, a discussion is not necessarily an endorsement. If I lived in Minneapolis and had no part in Paradigm Symposium, I think I would still attend an event like this because I find it interesting. And, you know, the skeptical members of the audience that attend, we've had Bob Blaskowitz, of course, of Skeptical Inquirer in the past.
Yes,
we've had a lot of wonderful people from the skeptical community who are just as interested. Maybe they're certainly in opposition to a lot of those ideas, but they're nonetheless there. And you know, back 2 years ago, P.Z. Myers was one of the presenters. And,
yes.
And to people who say, why don't you get more big names in sci-fi? Why don't you get a Neil deGrasse Tyson or a Michio Kaku? You know, the thing go ahead.
Can I tell you?
Yes, please.
I researched getting Neil deGrasse Tyson here to speak as a keynote. And his people were very excited to have him come on board. And then I found out that his fee for speaking for 2 hours cost more than buying a new house.
Yeah.
And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And I said to his handlers, I said, well, I only make half that when I get to speak. And they didn't laugh.
Well, so, the truth is, though, you know, we've reached out. Well, I say this, you and John Ward these days, you know, doing a fine job with that, by the way. But it's not like those people haven't been approached. It's just on the budget that you guys have. I understand, and I hope that people are clear on that. It's not that Neil deGrasse Tyson and these guys aren't invited, but they do.
It's that they cost basically our full budget for the entire event to get one speaker in. Now, maybe 1 year we'll just do one speaker and that's it.
But, right.
You know, who knows? And let me say just one thing. I know we're very short on time.
Go ahead.
But about the considering things, we're all skeptics to a certain extent. We're not part of the skeptical movement, but we're skeptics, meaning we question things. We want to know what's there. And I want to quote, you mentioned my partner in crime, John Ward, has always said, he says, Scotty, we weren't there. We don't know. And so we kind of have that approach to say, we're willing to give the stage up to some people with whom we might not necessarily agree or believe their whole kit bag, but we give them the opportunity to speak because, you know what? We weren't there and we don't know. They might have some information that is valuable, even though we choose to not believe that particular category where they're plugged in. And so we like to leave it open to that and let people say, you make your minds up. You come, you listen. And do some research. Don't just say, I disbelieve in UFOs because I disbelieve in UFOs. Why not come and listen to the people who have researched this stuff and find out what they have to say?
Absolutely. And I think I, on certain points, disagree equally with P.Z. Myers and Graham Hancock. But both of those gentlemen, the presentations that they gave were incredible. They were nothing short of fabulous. I really enjoyed them both. I can put aside ideological differences I may have with a person, so long as they present well and they do something to try and inform the public. And that's certainly something that you find in a lot of ways at the Paradigm Symposium. Before I let you go real quick, Scotty, please tell people where they can find out about it online.
All right. Very easy. ParadigmSymposium.com. And if you go over there, you're going to, it's all on one page unless you want to click into, by the way, the itinerary is being finalized and it is not up yet. All the itinerary is where we plug certain speakers into certain times of the day. That's not up in there yet. But if you just scroll down the page, you'll see all the speakers. Click on their pictures. You'll see bios of them. If you scroll further down the page, you'll see the PayPal Buy Now button for the pass. And you scroll a little further down, and we have a banquet. And this year we're having, we've traditionally done a panel discussion at the banquet. This time we're going to have some fun entertainment during the banquet, and you'll see that. And the banquet is a separate ticket from the weekend lecture pass ticket. So go down there, and at the very bottom of the page is the Crown Plaza Suites, where we're going to be holding this. It's the Crown Plaza Mall of America, which is 5 minutes from the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and then 5 minutes the other direction from the very famous Mall of America. And they run shuttles all day back and forth to both places. So we are self-contained this year, hotel, event, all in one location.
Excellent. Brother, thank you so much for jumping on. Always good to talk with you. We'll catch up again when we have a little more time in the next couple of days. And of course, as everybody keeps asking me, hey, are you going to be in Minneapolis this year? Of course I will be. I'm there every year.
Of course you will be emceeing the event as three previous years. And Micah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate
it. It's always my pleasure. And honestly, I think it's my honor, privilege, and pleasure. We'll put it that way.
That works, brother.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. You have a wonderful night. And again, folks, do check it out at www.paradigmsymposium.com. And before I wrap up this hour, I want to also touch on something that has certainly been in the news that has to do with artificial intelligence, which is something that we also talk about. Maybe we'll get a little into that. That's something that Scotty, I know, has in the past for a long time wanted to incorporate into the lectures that we present at Paradigm Symposium. And I believe I actually reached out at one point to see if there would be interest among, I won't give his name here, but a very prominent member of the research community in relation to that. But there was this story recently about an AI experiment that was used with these little NAO robots. They're really cute little things, and there's a video that you can see online. We've got a link to the Graylian Daily News today, as a matter of fact. But this experiment used a variant of a logical puzzle that's known popularly as the King's Wise Men, okay? And this is essentially how this worked. In this instance, we had this trio of little robots, and things have been simplified a little bit because these robots are not designed to be self-aware, but what happens is they are made aware of something more of like a concept in this case called a dumbing pill, okay? In actuality, it's just a little button on top of their heads that allows them to be silenced. The tester on camera then proceeds to tap the heads of each robot, but only two are really given the pill. In other words, the button's only activated on two of them. And then he asks which pill they received. Now, all three of them will try to answer, I don't know, but since only one of them can actually really speak, it's the one that stands up and audibly says it. But after a few seconds, it realizes this and concludes that it didn't receive the dumbing pill. In other words, it appears to have become self-aware that it was able to speak and arrived at a logical conclusion in doing so. With the little time that we have, I do have a bit of audio that features this.
Which pill did you receive?
I don't know. Sorry, I know now. I was able to prove that I was not given a dumbing pill.
Wow. Sorry, I know now. I was able to prove that I was not given the dumbing pill. That is, again, the parameters here and the circumstances, we're not seeing full-fledged self-awareness or artificial intelligence. But this is nonetheless eerie because, I mean, it's almost like seeing little children standing and thinking and talking. Little robotic children. Slashkey reported, none of these except the knowledge about the dumbing pill were pre-programmed. In case you might be wondering if there was a trick to this, the NAO robots were able to understand the question and also recognize their own voice. And on hearing it, it will realize that it is logically impossible that they receive the dumbing pill. It's rather crude at this point, but it forms the basis of artificial consciousness, the building blocks of a truly sentient robotic future that awaits us. Boy, that is truly interesting to me. And even though we're only seeing the very beginnings, we're only scratching the surface, it's really starting to get to the point where we can really not just visualize AI, we can see it right in front of us. Almost. Tomorrow's going to be really interesting, let me tell you. When we come back, we'll get into some esoteric musicology here on the Graylian Report.
also politics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gralian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
That's right, from the high mountains of Appalachia, kicking off our second hour. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. It is the Gralian Report. And as promised, we're going to be discussing the anomalous world of music during this hour. Being a musician myself, it is a subject I am intimately acquainted with, and it is going to be my task in this hour to acquaint you with this just as well. And of course, we know a lot of stories about a lot of musicians who have claimed to have everything from alien contact. One of those stories we're going to delve pretty deeply into during this hour. But there seems to be more to it than all that just as well. But before we get into all that, I do want to remind you, if you aren't already, you may want to check out Gralian X. It's easy to do, and it's lots of fun just as well. Weekly additional editions, as well as monthly installments of the Crypto X podcast, and of course the ever-popular Gralian Enigmas. Just think about it like this. It's $7 a month, $77 a year. For what you would spend on a fast food meal, you can get a whole additional set of monthly installments of Gralian Report goodness. So don't miss out on that. Head on over to GralianReport.com/X and do take a minute to check that out. Now, to preface this discussion about music, I'm going to, as I often tend to do, I'm going to bring this in on a seemingly unrelated note that many people will probably be scratching their heads over and saying, okay, where is this going? What does this have to do with music? And this is my line of thought. You've seen this story in the news recently, okay, that has been made much ado of, and it involves a British professor's new model of solar cycles, which apparently predicts, according to him, that the Earth could be headed toward a mini ice age. This is, of course, presented a rather contentious debate because, as conventional wisdom tells us, that the Earth is, well, I don't know, you know, some even climate scientists these days aren't comfortable with the use of the term global warming. They say, really, I think Bill Nye has even gone on the record and said, really, you should say climate change. That's a more accurate description. And one of the reasons why is, of course, because it's not always warming trends that occur, although that seems in the broader sense to be what we've been observing over at least the last several decades. But there's this new model that is reporting that an apparent mini ice age could occur, maybe in a few years. And this would create conditions similar to what happened back in the middle 1600s, which actually extended on up around till the time of the American Revolution, which was called the Maunder Minimum. And, of course, there were records of the Thames River in London being completely frozen over. And during this mini ice age that was reported, what was apparently occurring around the same time that astronomers noted was a lack of sunspot activity. Now, NASA in the last few years has monitored our sun and seen similar things, and they've maybe not equated this with any kind of a cooling trend, but some have said, hey, you know, if this were to continue, we may see conditions very similar to what we saw during that period known as the Maunder Minimum. Now, solar activity, again, may fall by as much as 60% during the 2030s, according to a mathematics professor, Valentina Zarkova of Northumbria University in England. Later this month, Zarkova and her co-authors presented the results of their study of three solar cycles between 1976 and 2008 at the Royal Astronomical Society's National Astronomy Meeting. Now, let's back up just a moment. In 1843, scientists discovered that solar activity varies over a cycle of roughly 10 to 12 years. And this is pretty often cited, especially by NASA and other agencies. And CNS News reported on this recently, saying that variations within the cycle are hard to predict, although it is known that a dynamo, magnetic waves rotating like a conveyor belt, deep inside the sun causes many of the variations. Now, this dynamo, which is caused by a convecting fluid deep within the sun, is what causes the irregular heartbeat of the sun, according to RAS. And now, this dynamo, okay, was also used in conjunction with a new method of collecting solar data by using a second set of magnetic waves that they found close to the sun's surface, probably those emitted by that giant mothership everybody says is hanging out there, which, of course, we all know that, you know, a burning star is the very, very best place for a spaceship to go and hide. But Zarkova predicts, based on this new method of collection of solar data, that solar cycles will cancel each other out between 2020 and 2030. And again, they always said hindsight was 20/20, but I digress. So using a pair of dynamos instead of one single dynamo, Zarkova and her team say they believe that they've created a more accurate model of future solar activity, which they also compared to the number of sunspots currently at the lowest level in more than 100 years. Again, this is very similar to what was observed by astronomers way back in the day during this little ice age that occurred, known as the Maunder Minimum. And so she says, combining both waves together and comparing to real data for the current solar cycle, we found that our prediction showed an accuracy, get this, of 97%. Now, there are some people who are really, really standing athwart this notion. They really don't buy it. But again, just looking at what she's saying right here, she says, combining both waves, putting this together, we think that we're, you know, we have an accuracy likelihood of 97%. And they collected data from Stanford University's Wilcox Solar Observatory. And according to this data, the model predicts that in cycle 25, which peaks in 2022, they say the sun's magnetic waves will be even more out of sync than they are right now. And then between 2020 and 2040, they say in cycle 26, the model predicts the pair of waves will nearly cancel each other out. And hence, here's what she says. In cycle 26, the two waves exactly mirror each other, peaking at the same time but in opposite hemispheres of the sun. Their interaction will be disruptive, or they will nearly cancel each other. We predict that this will lead to the properties of a Maunder minimum. Now, this is really interesting to me because, again, you know, you have to take into consideration that there is a possibility this could happen again. And I have wondered, honestly, in fairness, whether or not this may be at least one contributing factor to broader climate change. And I think that part of the reason that there's so much contention about that is the notion that, well, we are trying to look at things that humans may be doing that are causing climate change. And I think that without removing the anthropogenic concerns, we could at least consider, hey, could it possibly be that our heat source, the sun, could in some way be affecting all this? And really, in truth, obviously it is. But again, if this new statistical model is correct, we may have to take into consideration other things just as well. I guess in the coming years, if we start seeing trends toward cooling temperatures, especially around 2020 or 2040, those of us who are around then, well, maybe we'll look back and remember and say, hot damn, what do you know? Here we are, and things are getting chilly. Now, why do I talk about this as a preface to discussion of music? Well, get this. This is something that I found to be of particular interest to me some time ago that was featured in the Science Frontiers source book project by William Corliss. And it was talking about whether solar activity could be linked with bursts of human creativity. As a matter of fact, they discuss all kinds of different human behavior and solar activity. Everything from peace that may occur during periods of sunspot activity. But looking at creativity, it says in a previous paper, S. Ertel reported evidence that suggests a link between the historical oscillations of scientific creativity and solar cyclical variation. Eddie's discovery of the abnormal secular periods of solar inactivity, in other words, Maunder minimum types, offered the opportunity to put the present hypothesis to a crucial test. They said, using time series of flourish years of creators in science, literature, and paintings, it was found that, as expected, cultural flourish curves show marked discontinuities, or bursts, after the onset of secular solar excursions, synchronously in Europe and China. During periods of extended solar excursions, bursts of creativity in painting, literature, and science succeeded one another with lags of about 10 to 15 years. And also the reported regularities of cultural output are prominent throughout these with eminent creators. They decrease with ordinary professionals. So it says the hypothesized extraterrestrial connection of human cultural history has thus been considerably strengthened. Interesting. Just not necessarily in the sense of there being alien extraterrestrial influences. Huh. But getting a little closer to home with things, there was another comment added here, which had been sourced from an article, The 500-Year Cycle in Music, The Modern Period. We are currently living in the last quarter century of the fifth 500-year cycle, it wrote, which began with the Italian Renaissance in the 15th century. All the harmonies we hear today were developed in this last cycle. So what does that mean? Well, so begins the final section of a recent reprinting of W.D. Allen's sweeping 1951 overview of the human fascination with music. But what's this about a 500-year cycle in music? The author writes, it turns out that not only is there a 500-year pulse in musical creativity, but nested within the long swings are 100-year subcycles. Now, Allen's article, as it appeared originally in the Journal of Human Ecology, ran to about 41 pages. And we're going to hit a few, pardon the pun, high notes here. Allen describes how musical theorists have proposed both supernatural and evolutionary explanations for this periodicity, which commenced some 2,500 years ago with the ancient Greeks. He's not convinced by either class of explanations. Instead, Allen has been beguiled by the long period tones of environmental cycles. And he wrote, now we have knowledge of a constantly operating cyclical factor in our cosmos, scientifically based on a massive inductive evidence that goes beyond recorded history into the tree ring records from centuries BC. For the first time, we are provided with a powerful conditioning factor, if not a determinant, in the creation of music. Here are two statements reflecting Allen's observations on the subject. After 1590, as a new warm period began in the 100-year cycle, a new golden age began in music, as in science. And in our own day, some composers have been extremely sensitive to cyclical changes. Stravinsky, notably in his return to neoclassicism after 1920, reflected the warm trend. And Corliss himself noted that left unexplained in the weather theory or culture is just how warm trends do seem to inspire creativity, whether that be, of course, scientific or artistic, or musical. If warmth alone were the crucial factor, we would expect to see an inspiring outpouring of great music from today's equatorial regions. So is it really just the warmth, or could it be something else? Could it be, who knows, the geomagnetic properties contained within all this, and the way that the Earth is affected by mass coronal ejections and other kinds of sunspot activity and the like? It's an interesting question, and so as we're getting into the odd areas of human thought and how it relates to music and the anomalies contained therein, just keep in mind that some researchers have even wondered whether or not the cyclical nature of the sun, the earth, the interrelationship between the two, the cosmos, if these kinds of things couldn't spike creativity, and whether there isn't a cyclical, a rhythmic fashion to how creativity actually emerges. We have creativity explosions and maybe intelligence explosions. What will be interesting is to see how warming trends, or maybe even cooling trends, as Dr. Sarkova over in Europe has suggested, but it's going to be interesting to see how those things affect human creativity and maybe even music in the coming years. So talking about nature and how nature and music are oriented with one another. You know, of course, I've always been fascinated with the idea of musical sounds that occur in nature, and there have been a lot of reports of interesting things. Certain fish make sounds, especially when they're spawning, and this can be interpreted as being almost like a musical kind of a sound that emerges from, you know, presumably beneath the water. And it's long been known that there are certain species of fish that do make these noises. We also have reports of pipe organ-like sounds coming from underground, which likely have geological reasons, especially in the early dawn hours. There were stories that those who would lay along the banks of the Orinoco on large stones would claim that if they were lying out there as the sun began to rise, and presumably as the ground began to warm, that they could hear strange musical-like sounds that appeared to emanate from below ground. And so we do have a lot of descriptions of, not just in my research into mystery booms, like I'm going to be talking about later tonight, 10 p.m. East Coast time, at the seminar that Jim Harold is hosting. But in addition to anomalous sounds in nature, yeah, we do have these musical tones that appear to emerge, for lack of a better term, just as well. But what if I told you that in addition to things that are naturally occurring in terms of natural music, that there are also people who use things from nature to create music? Like, consider, for instance, the two Chinese brothers you're about to hear using vegetables, yeah, potatoes, and different kinds of leeks and carrots to make musical instruments. And what's so bizarre about this is these guys are actually in quite in demand, but they maintain that a fresh vegetable is the one that's going to be optimum for making an instrument. And therefore, in order to be able to put on a performance, these guys have to recreate, they have to rebuild all of their instruments before every performance using fresh vegetables.
Tired of munching on taters, gnawing on carrots? Two brothers in Beijing have come up with an alternative use for roots, tubers, and gourds. Nan Wei Dong and Nan Wei Ping have refined the art of fashioning musical instruments from vegetables. The two were encouraged to study music by their music teacher father and came up with the idea of making instruments from vegetables 2 years ago. Nan Wei Dong explains that picking the right raw material is essential.
If the water content in vegetables evaporates, the tune will become higher than the basic tune or go out of tune. Therefore, we choose the vegetables with as much water content as possible. The vegetables have to be solid and hard. We can't use those vegetables left over for days. They're too soft to be played.
The brothers test the pitch of the instruments with an electronic tuner.
The deeper the hole, the lower the pitch. The shallower the hole, the higher the pitch. Besides, the size of the hole also matters to guarantee the quality of the sound. The leaks only serve as decoration. I made it based on the principles of how Chinese panpipes work.
By the way, you're about to hear this guy break bad on a bunch of carrots. Here we go.
These maestros of marrows have appeared on numerous TV shows and regularly receive payments of up to $7,000 for a performance. But vegetables have their shelf life, so each show requires a brand new set of carrot and leek panpipes and potato ocarinas.
Can you imagine that what would go into just getting your prep together for a performance? First, a trip to the market, yeah? And you thought that you really disliked peeling potatoes. Think how these guys must feel just to be able to go out. Now, granted, they're paid well for it, so I guess maybe the time invested in preparation for each performance is well worth it. Especially if they're paid $7,000 to go out there and, you know, make music on a potato ocarina or perhaps a flute made of carrots. Gosh, so bizarre. If you think that's weird, I don't know. That may not sound good to your ear. These guys actually seem to be quite melodic with it and also, you know, expert musicians as well. So it's not really all that bad. But there are people who have actually made a name for themselves as being less than good at the music that they produce. Like, for instance, there's the group, of course, the Shags. Apparently none of the band members really ever even wanted to form a band, nor did they really have any musical talent. But you know what? Apparently a fortune teller predicted that they would be successful, and so they did it anyway. Like I've always said, determination often, more than talent or anything else, will take you far in life. And that was certainly the case for Miss Florence Foster Jenkins. Carnegie Hall, apparently when she performed, was filled past capacity. There were lines stretching down 7th Avenue and around 56th Street. The will call window was demanding IDs. And here we had the 76-year-old soprano, Miss Jenkins, Madam Jenkins as she was referred to, as was her preference according to an article in PS Mag. They called her Lady Florence. She'd rented the hall on her own dime for an operatic recital that would the following day be described by Robert Bagan in the New York World Telegram as a night of nights in the musical annals of this fair city. And celebrity gossip columnist Earl Wilson, writing in the Post, was far blunter. He called it one of the weirdest mass jokes New York has ever seen. And what they have said, of course, of this famous incident was that Florence Foster Jenkins was and will forever be the worst singer to appear at Carnegie Hall. She's arguably the worst singer to ever devote herself wholeheartedly to and fail so fully at the craft of singing. Wilson summed it up acidly. She can sing anything but notes. The records she made, the sole surviving oral evidence of the craft, are a cacophony of squawks and screeches, great careering arcs grasping vertiginously for high D's, E's, and F's that come cluckingly wild, frantically down again. She sang in public so consistently and so consistently badly that she became one of New York City's most prominent musical cult figures. And since her death in 1944, she's become one of the world's. The hilarity and ultimately the tragedy of Jenkins' story is that she remained blissfully and utterly convinced of her ability until the bittersweet of ends. In other words, she never quite seemed to pick up on the fact that the anomaly about her music wasn't how good it was. It was, in fact, how bad she was and how fascinated people were with how bad she was. Fascinating. But think about how many musicians have made careers off of not really being great at what they do. In fact, when they're rough around the edges, some would argue it gives it a little bit more, well, I don't know, kind of a folksy appeal. We'll look at some of the spiritual connections with music when we return here on the Graylian Report. Yes, how better to kick off a discussion about strange spiritual influences in music than the sultry sounds of Lady Florence Foster Jenkins? Yes, the glory of the human voice indeed. There she is, squealing Queen of the Night by Mozart. Yes, indeed. Actually, I'll tell you though, just to be honest, I've heard worse singers in my day. I really have. As a musician, yeah, she isn't the best. But she's maybe not the very worst I've ever heard. Now, speaking of eccentric musicians, Rosemary Brown ranks among probably some of the most famous of the last century. She was a middle-aged widow living in a London suburb in the 1960s when she began to say that she'd been in contact with history's most illustrious composers. And she offered as evidence hundreds of piano miniatures that she said Beethoven, Bach, and others had dictated to her in the truest spiritual sense. She died in November of 2001, but the odd experiences that she described as reported at the time of her death in the New York Times, they included shopping with Liszt. He was interested in the price of bananas. She watched television with Chopin. He apparently was very appalled by what he saw. She found a resonant audience in the era of the Beatles and Flower Power by doing so also. And more intriguingly, they attracted expert scrutiny and some approbation from such luminaries as Leonard Bernstein, along with tidal waves of more or less good-natured ridicule from most of the music establishment. Now, Miss Brown's credibility as a medium was buttressed by her own musical ignorance. She had just 3 years of piano instruction and could not play by ear or extemporize. In other words, she didn't really have a good sense of how to jam, you know, how to solo or how to improvise. There was no record player or radio in her home, and she said that she had never even gone to concerts. I seemed to lose control of my hands, is what she claimed happened when the compositions came to her. It was as though someone else were guiding them. Now, Peter Catton, an outstanding interpreter of Chopin, had apparently been pleased to record many of these piano works. While the composer Humphrey Searle published an essay noting the similarity of Mrs. Brown's Liszt pieces with his later official compositions, Mr. Bernstein suggested he could buy, meaning accept, a piece of Rachmaninoff, but not much else. Interesting. And André Previn, apparently the conductor at the time of the London Symphony Orchestra, said that if the newfound compositions were genuine, they would have best been left on the shelf. You know, it's funny, in other words, when you start seeing musicians and music critics going after these claims. You know, to hell with a professional debunker or skeptic. When someone claims that they're channeling pieces of music that were written by dead composers, you know, you don't need a scientist or a magician to debunk this. Just, you know, get a composer. Ah, interesting. If she is a fake, however, it was said by British composer Richard Rodney Bennett. Now, he was really convinced. He said if she's a fake, she's a brilliant one and must have had years of training. He said this in an interview with Time magazine. Some of the music is awful, some is marvelous. I couldn't have faked the Beethoven. And he believed this woman really did seem to have some incredible ability to channel music from someplace else. Meanwhile, there are others who claim that really there are curses associated with these kinds of compositions. Maybe not those channeled. Have you ever heard of what's called the curse of the ninth, for instance? It's a superstition that has long been associated with classical music, especially. Although I wonder if it could apply to guys like Frank Zappa or somebody. Then again, I guess with all the compositions that he put together, that probably wouldn't have been the case. But it essentially has to do with the idea that the Ninth Symphony that a composer puts together is destined to be their last. Remember, by the way, as I'm telling you this about the curse of the ninth, that John Lennon was fascinated with the idea of the number nine. You remember that? I mean, he, as a matter of fact, I think on the White Album, there was the song that ended as you hear John repeating, number nine, number nine, number nine. So the folk notion apparently kind of persists into the modern day. And as we talk about this, you know, it makes for an interesting segue into a different discussion, which has everything to do with John Lennon. Not only the anomalies of music in nature, not only the anomalies of those who claim that they are able to either channel music or curses associated with it, but then the musicians themselves that have extraordinary experiences. We have a lot of them that have occurred over the years. A lot of people, I mean, members of the Moody Blues. I don't know if he ever claimed that he was an abductee, but I know that Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, Tom Danheiser of Coast to Coast AM told me that that Billy Gibbons was extremely interested in this sort of stuff, and that apparently Lee Spiegel, our buddy, had put those two together because they were trying to find someone who was in rock and roll who was interested in UFOs, and Billy is really into it. There are a lot of people in musical circles who have either claimed to have had contact experiences or they've channeled music and downloaded stuff, you know, in the proverbial sense of the great download from the mother throne. Many musicians, Eric Johnson, the, you know, the instrumental guitarist, who I should note has a home studio that's shaped like a flying saucer. He's often said that sometimes, you know, you don't know where those notes come from. Ricky Skaggs, bluegrass and country artist, he's the very one who used that term download from the mother throne. He says you sometimes get these songs so quickly that, you know, you can't keep up with it. It's like they're just dictated to you or that they come to you from someplace else. And as a musician myself, I've even had that experience where you're lying in bed and you're in that state between asleep and awake. And you hear music, and it's not popular music, it's not a music that anyone has ever written or performed, but you're hearing music. I can hear sometimes, when I'm in that state between asleep and awake, I can hear music in my head that is, it's almost like I'm listening to it on a radio. And there have been times where I've jumped up and written down lyrics. I mean, that's how complete the compositions are. And it is really strange. It's almost like you're tuned as your brain enters that altered state, which is actually, I mean, a different, an altered state from, you know, the everyday and the waking state, is you are heading, you may be a theta state, you know, but, you know, and we could get into a long conversation about binaural rhythms, but many musicians have talked about the fact that they have experienced this, wow, the song just came to me, or the song actually came to them in a dream. I believe that the song Yesterday, Paul McCartney claimed that that song came to him in a dream, and of course went on to be, I think, maybe one of the most recorded pop songs by various artists of the 20th century. But his fellow co-founder of the Beatles, John Lennon, is a very interesting case when it comes to discussing anomalistic musicology, because John Lennon is not only one of the most visible celebrities in the world of music to have had a strange experience, but he also, I think, had one of the more credible observations of a UFO over New York City. And interestingly, although this has been talked about a lot over the years, I know that Tim Beckley's discussed it. I think Peter Robbins and I talked about it a little bit when I was up there in New York visiting. And I've heard Grant Cameron discuss it just as well. But this case actually may have more impact and may certainly have had more impact on John Lennon than many people are aware of.
Over here, up there, I saw a UFO and it went down the river, turn right at the United Nations, turn left, and then down the river. It wasn't a helicopter, it wasn't a balloon, and it was so near.
And it looked what, sort of round, just, white, just luminescent, like, and silent?
Silent, and it looked dark, like black or grey in the middle, and had white lights, just looked like light bulbs, you know? Just going off, on, off, on, off, on, blink, 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 round the bottom, and on top was a red light.
We were finishing up the Walls and Bridges album that John had been working on. And he decided to take a walk out on our terrace. And now, mind you, he is nude. And all of a sudden I hear him yelling out to me, going, "May, come out here." So I go running out to the terrace. And I go, "What is it? I mean, what?" And I stopped. And I looked up and I saw this saucer-like thing over our head, going over us very, very slowly, like a snail. And as it was flying over us, it just sort of wavered, it just tilted, went on sort of on its side a little, And I'm screaming, it's a UFO! And there was no noise coming out of it. That's what was amazing. And it just hovered over this building for a good 5 minutes. It turned around and it moved out and it just went straight up into the sky. We just watched it go straight up.
Dr. Bob Hieronymus produces a program called 21st Century Radio in Baltimore that specializes in the paranormal.
The John Lennon story is so convincing. 71% of Americans do not believe that the government is telling them the truth about UFOs. John Lennon represented to most of us an individual that we could trust who would tell the truth. And if he saw these things, then we thought they were credible.
John Lennon didn't keep the sighting to himself. He called the police, and they told him they'd already gotten 3 calls. He called a newspaper. They'd gotten 6. Within days, John Lennon was also on the phone to a radio station, where he spoke to all who were tuned in.
There's a couple of quotes on your new album I found amusing and interesting enough to ask you about. Possession is 9/10 of the problem.
Oh, yeah.
That seems to be on your album. And did you really see a UFO?
I did really. I wouldn't have put it on, you know, if I hadn't seen it.
There's a little tiny note that people could miss if they don't look carefully down in one of the lower corners of your liner notes. It says, I saw a UFO September something, something, something. What was the story behind that? Where did that happen?
Well, I was in New York in an apartment, and I was just standing by the roof, and I looked left, and there was this thing about 100 yards away, and I could have hit it with a stone if I threw it. And it was really, I could have even seen it without my glasses, and I'm very short-sighted. And I was looking at it and thinking, what is it? What is it? You know, is it a helicopter? No, it's making no noise. Is it a balloon? You know, is it the blimp? Because uh-huh. There's all these lights around the bottom of it,
uh-huh.
Flashing on and off.
It didn't say American Airlines on it, did it?
It didn't say anything. It didn't make a noise. And you know, one part of me all the time was saying, that's a UFO, you know.
Uh-huh.
But some part of you doesn't want to believe it, you know.
Did you go to the authorities with that information?
I didn't, because, you know, Lennon sees UFO. I mean, that's enough to get me kicked out for, you know, it's bad enough as it is.
I suppose.
That's why I almost took it off the album. But one time I said, pull it off. A, I'm going to get people with weird-looking eyes coming up to me saying, I've come from the saucer, you know.
And I've seen it too, yeah.
Yeah, and the other bit is they're going to say he's crazy, you know. But I thought, look, I saw it, you know, I don't care what anybody says, there it was, and nobody can explain what it was to me, so I said UFO, you know.
Amazing, this is in California.
No, this was in New York.
New York, of all places.
Below the height of the buildings. I mean, it was like, you know, if somebody had been in a higher building, they would have looked down on it.
Did you talk to anybody else that said they saw it too?
I got a friend to call the police and call the newspapers the next day
uh-huh.
to check if anybody else had seen anything.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of people had rung in and seen something in the same area at the same time as me.
People in New York are sometimes oblivious to reality, though. Things could be happening around them and they wouldn't even notice it. You know,
well, I'll stick up for New York a bit. I think it's pretty real here, you know. It's just that, you know, I would never have noticed if I hadn't happened to look out. You know, I looked around me and nobody else was looking out of windows or anything. The cars were going on because it's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
It's very low. It's not that you expect a sort of Martian in the sky. It was below rooftop level and it was just coasting around very quietly like a tourist, you know.
It's amazing.
And it was just potluck that I saw it.
Amazing.
Excuse the expression. And I was straight as a die. I was straight as a die.
It is quite a story indeed, and just a couple of notes, of course, that was May Pang, who had been his former secretary and girlfriend at the time that you heard in that portion of the interview from the audio montage we featured there. That wasn't Yoko Ono, although he went back to Yoko shortly after this incident. And, of course, you also heard from Dr. Bob Hieronymus, who I believe probably is a fellow Time Lord, after sharing a couple of beverages with him at the Fort Fest last spring. Wonderful guy. And again, just one of many who has taken interest in this story. I should point out, by the way, that I believe it was his fifth studio album released in, I think, the fall of 1974. It was Walls and Bridges that he had been working on at the time that he and May Pang observed that UFO. And on that album, he is discussed a bit in that interview. He'd gone back and forth on whether to publicize this, but he seemed to really want John Lennon to get on record that he had had this experience. And so on certain printings of the album, in the lower left-hand corner, rather simply, the words appear as follows. On the 23rd of August, 1974, at 9 o'clock, I saw a UFO and the initials JL. I mean, it really seemed to have a profound effect on him. And of course, during the interviews that appeared subsequently, Lenin seemed more than comfortable to talk about it. We know that, of course, Mei Pang had kept images, drawings that John had produced that actually displayed what the thing looked like. And it was essentially your typical round saucer with a slightly conical shape on the top, a red light near the top of the comb on the upper portion of this craft, and then lights that were circulating or moving in a circular fashion, I suppose, around the perimeter toward the base. But essentially, it was a disc or saucer-shaped object that they saw. And John had even said to Mei Pang at one point, you know, I wish that they'd taken me with them. I would love to have gone with them. Under this assumption, of course, that what he was seeing was something extraterrestrial. But the story gets even weirder, because apparently John had also claimed at one point that he even had maybe some sort of a contact experience with actual occupants, and that they had given him some sort of a little gift that apparently resembled a Fabergé egg. And of course, that little object, I think, is maybe still in the possession of one Yuri Geller, who, for those of you who ran out and watched the documentary An Honest Liar, you know exactly who Yuri Geller is. Many say he's the most incredible psychic in the world. Apparently, he was, at very least, if nothing else, a good friend of John Lennon's. So, you know, it's a really strange story, but I think that often people tell it and it's just kind of a funny, you know, story about a fairly weird guy anyway. As he referred to himself there, you know, John Lennon called himself a freak, but obviously a brilliant freak, an incredible musician. Probably my favorite Beatle, I guess, you know, the one that that resonates the most with me, being the weird one and being the deep introspective songwriter type, and also a guy who seemed to have been profoundly changed and moved even by what he and his girlfriend at the time saw during that experience. What would you make of something like that? If you had been standing on that balcony and you'd had that experience and you saw this thing show up. But as far as the weirdness with regard to the Beatles goes, I mean, it doesn't end right there. You've probably heard of the Zombeatles. Maybe you haven't. It's a parody version of the rock group. Okay, they were out of Madison, Wisconsin, apparently. And they put together a video back in 2006 called A Hard Day's Night of the Living Dead. And apparently Rob Zombie chose it as one of his top YouTube Halloween video picks of the following year, which resulted in over 1 million views worldwide. But they put out a lot of albums that were kind of playing off of Beatles album titles. Like, instead of Meet the Beatles, you had Meet the Zombeatles, written M-E-A-T. But what also is funny about that is that we can spoof this all day long if we want to. But as was pointed out to me a short time ago by my friend and fellow esotericist, Mr. Vance Pollock, who I almost thought about trying to get on the show tonight because we have so much in common in terms of our interest in esoterica as it relates to rock and roll culture. We were joking around one night, and I believe I told the story on this program about the infamous Butcher cover that appeared as an alternate cover, which had been, in fact, the original cover for the album Yesterday and Today that the Beatles put out. It was their 9th album. And prior to its release, the cover was changed because apparently the conceptual art piece, as it was called, titled A Somnambulant Adventure, depicted the Fab Four in butcher smocks, draped with pieces of meat and body parts from plastic baby dolls. Jim Harold, when he used to work in radio, said that he remembered somebody coming by the studio with a copy of it. And what happened was apparently that they decided not to use this unusual and probably extremely controversial, maybe even unsettling photo. And so early printings of the album, they actually pasted the more, you know, famous album cover, which shows a suitcase, and John's actually sitting atop the suitcase, Paul McCartney's within it, and then you see Ringo and George standing behind Paul and John. That was the famous album cover that actually went to print, but that early printing that they had already produced contained the Butcher cover underneath. Certain collectors who caught wind of this began very carefully peeling back that pasted cover to reveal the original. And hence, Vance bringing this to my attention said, Mike, if we ever start a band, we've got to call it the Butcher Cover Peelers. Yeah, I think that's a pretty brilliant name. And yes, it certainly gives a totally different meaning to Meet the Beatles. But when it comes to the Beatles and the weirdness associated with them, I think that getting into the realm of conspiracy theories, there were some people who tried to say that with John Lennon's sighting of a UFO, and the fact that, of course, you know, with his left-leaning activism, and the fact that he had been actually the object of a campaign for removal of the United States. I think that the FBI had been surveilling him. There were some who were trying to deport him. You know, he was very much a controversial figure right up until his final days. And so there have been some who have further asserted that John Lennon was removed rather than assassinated, which I don't buy at all, by the way. But nonetheless, the theory persists in certain circles of a conspiracy to have John Lennon taken out because he had seen too much. Not only was he an object of U.S. intelligence agencies, not only had he gotten on the fecal roster of guys like Richard Nixon and even Elvis Presley, no, John Lennon also had seen a UFO, and damn, that was just too much. Arguably one of the more strange conspiracy theories associated with the Beatles, but maybe second yet to the famous Paul is Dead conspiracy theory, which I'm sure many of you will remember. The idea that apparently the theory had been that Paul McCartney had been killed, I believe in a car accident, and that there were clues about his death that could be uncovered if you looked carefully at lyrics and artwork on the Beatles recordings. I think the Abbey Road album cover was a particular point of interest among the conspiracy theorists because Paul, of course, is depicted in front of George walking, wearing a suit but wearing no shoes. So fans had said that there were a lot of things. They said that there were purportedly messages that if you played the album backwards, you could hear. There was also the allegation that John Lennon could be very softly heard saying at the end of the song, Strawberry Fields Forever, I buried Paul. And further extrapolating about the idea that Paul, in the cover of the Abbey Road album, is actually not Paul, but some sort of a stand-in, and that album cover is some sort of a symbol. The idea had been that it was a funeral procession, and what we see here is George Harrison, of course, he's really, really dressed down. He's wearing, like, you know, denim jeans and a shirt. So he's supposedly the gravedigger. Paul McCartney, of course, being out of step with the rest of the band members and barefoot, is supposed to be the corpse. We've got, of course, Ringo Starr, who is an undertaker because he's wearing all black, and then we've got the clergyman, John Lennon, dressed all in white, leading the procession. And so the conspiracy theory went on to cite that that Paul had, you know, again been killed, and so what happened was the Beatles, rather than ceasing their operations or replacing him with someone new, which seemed unfathomable, of course, for the Fab Four, what they did was they actually had a stand-in who underwent plastic surgery and was made to look like Paul McCartney and also became a magnificent musician, not just a bass player, because keeping in mind all the other instruments that Paul played, guitar, piano, everything, hell, ukulele. And so this guy learns how to play all these parts and all these instruments, or happened to be a magnificent musician to begin with, who was physically altered to look like Paul. It's almost ridiculous. So in 1969, the Beatles press office issued statements denying this rumor and called it a load of old rubbish. And then apparently McCartney, also interviewed in November of that year by Life magazine, said, "Perhaps the rumor started because I haven't been much in the press lately. I've done enough press for a lifetime, and I don't have anything to say these days, and I'm happy to be with my family, and I will work when I work. I was switched on for 10 years, and I never switched off, and now I'm switching off whenever I can. I would rather be a little less famous these days." But that wasn't good enough for a lot of people, you know, and people, of course, still maintained that maybe Paul indeed had died. There were a lot of records that were released on the subject. The Ballad of Paul, I think, by the group The Mystery Tour. Billy Shears, of course, Brother Paul, All the Americans, and So Long Paul by Werbley Finster, a pseudonym for Jose Feliciano. I mean, it really became a pop cultural phenom. And with that in mind, no discussion of esotericism in modern pop music would really be complete. There's so much more that could be said. We could do a whole show about it, but I really want to touch on that famous synchronicity of synchronicities, the one we call the Dark Side of Oz. Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, and The Wizard of Oz, when we come back here on The Graylian Report.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, finishing up this week's edition. And as we wrap things up, I want to spend a little time looking, of course, at that most famous conspiracy. One for the books, right out of Oz, The Dark Side of the Rainbow, as some call it, or Dark Side of Oz, or The Wizard of Floyd. All different kinds of names have been used to refer to this. And, you know, again, I think really we could do a show not just about weirdness in music, but, I mean, you could break it up into people who claim that they are musicians who have been abducted by aliens, you know, groups who have been involved in weird conspiracy theories. This is kind of one of those. And to this day, the members of the band Pink Floyd maintain that if there is any connection between their album, Dark Side of the Moon, and the film The Wizard of Oz, it was strictly coincidental. Nothing was ever intended, is what they've said. And if you're unfamiliar with this story, I mean, this is how it goes. Back in 1995, there was an article that was published in the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette that talked about the apparent synchronicities that occur when you begin the album Dark Side of the Moon around the time, I think, that the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, if I remember correctly, I think that when the lion begins to roar, you know, around that time they tell you start the album and you'll start seeing. I wonder who possibly could have ever found this out. Who decided to time it to this exact moment and then just play the album alongside the film? You turn down the volume, you watch The Wizard of Oz, and you let Dark Side of the Moon roll. And it's incredible because there have been, Turner Classic Movies has aired this, and there are a lot of movie theaters nowadays, especially a few here in Asheville, that will from time to time, maybe once a year, they'll actually play these two together. You can buy a version of Dark Side of the Moon, I believe, put to The Wizard of Oz so that you can see this for yourself. It's incredible. There have been a lot of people who've talked about this. And, you know, people, some look at it as being, again, purely coincidental. Some say that it is so bizarre the way this all lines up that there's no way you could deny either heavy, heavy synchronicity or something that was purely intended. Now, Alan Parsons, who had been the audio engineer who worked on this, you know, he had even gone on record and said it was an American radio guy who pointed it out to me. It's such a non-starter, a complete load of eyewash. I tried it for the first time about 2 years ago. One of my fiancé's kids had a copy of the video, and I thought I had to see what it was all about, and I was very disappointed. He said the only thing I noticed was that the line "balanced on the biggest wave" came up when Dorothy was kind of tightrope walking along a fence. Well, that's not really even one of the more remarkable purported synchronicities. One of the things any audio professional will tell you is that the scope of the drift between the video and the record is enormous. It could be anything up to 20 seconds by the time the record's finished. And anyway, if you play any record with the sound turned down on the TV, you'll just find things that work. In fact, there are people who say that if you use different albums as the soundtrack for different classic movies, I mean, you will almost inevitably find the same sorts of synchronicities that begin to occur. I think one had involved using The Wall, the Pink Floyd album, which of course there was a film for that just as well, but using that as the soundtrack for the film Alice in Wonderland, people have purportedly gotten very similar results. Now, there was a newsletter years ago that I used to subscribe to. It was called The Straight Dope, and in May of 2000, they featured this as a discussion in the column. Someone had written in and asked, is it true that Pink Floyd's album Dark Side of the Moon, when played along with The Wizard of Oz, happens to coincide with plot changes in the film? And they wrote back, we get this question all the time here at The Straight Dope, and we're starting to realize, sheesh, isn't an adequate answer. So here's a better one. Almost certainly not. But let's take a look. And this is the origin of the myth, they said. Helen Kennedy in 1997, writing for the Daily News, was one of many who wrote about the synchronicity. She noted the lyrics and music join in a cosmic sync, with the action forming dozens upon dozens of startling coincidences, the kind that make you go, oh, wow, man, even if you haven't been near a bong in 20 years. Here are some of the examples. Floyd sings, the lunatic is on the grass just as the scarecrow begins his floppy jig near a green lawn. The line, gotta keep the loonies on the path, comes just before Dorothy and the scarecrow start traipsing down the yellow brick road. During the song Time, Dorothy breaks into a trot to the line, no one told you when to run. When Dorothy leaves the fortune teller to go back to her farm, the album is playing Home, Home Again. Glinda the Saccharine Good Witch in the North appears in her bubble just as the band sings, don't give me that do-goody-good bull. A few minutes later, the Good Witch confronts the Wicked Witch as the band sings, and who knows which is which. You get it? But there's more. The song Brain Damage starts about the same time as the Scarecrow launches into If I Only Had a Brain.
And here's the real clincher. At the end of the album, which tails off with the insistent sound of a beating heart, what's happening on the screen? You guessed it. Dorothy's got her ear to the Tin Man's chest, listening for a heartbeat. And there are more and more of them. So what do we make of all this? Is it a coincidence? Was it planned? Or is it, as some followers of Carl Jung would have us believe, some sort of collective, unconscious synchronicity? I mean, at times, some of us, we look at that and it's almost impossible to ignore. I don't know, I'd like to hear from you. If you've ever watched the two paired together, Wizard of Oz and Dark Side of the Moon, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. info@graylianreport.com. But that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program as we end our foray into anomalous musicality. And from the bottom of our musical hearts here at Graylian International, we bid you adieu, my friends, on behalf of Matt Oakley, Caleb Hanks, John Anderson, Chris Hayes, Jeremy London, Dick Oakley, Raisin Robert Hobbs, Tyler Pittman, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South. We bid you adieu. As always, my friends, stay musically strange, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.